Now, a special conversation between Tony Hsieh and Dr. Warren Bennis, recorded at University of Southern California Marshall School of Business. Introduction by Dave Logan.
Starting with Dr. Bennis, if you go online and read one of his many bios, you'll hear things like the fact that he's named by Forbes magazine as Dean of the Leadership Gurus and that his books have been nominated for various prizes and have done all sorts of good things. And that's all true. And it's about like saying Abraham Lincoln was tall and had a beard. Okay. So here's the truth about Dr. Bennis. It's been said that you can tell the difference between an expert and a master if you ask them a question. And the expert will tell you the answer. And then you go away and you feel smarter because you know the answer. And the master will say, that's a really interesting question. Why don't you sit down and we'll talk about it? Which is why you often see Dr. Bennis sitting down with various people talking about some interesting things. And typical of how masters like to conduct sessions, you'll notice that we have a couple of chairs here so that we get to sit down and learn together. I would say that if you can get inside the way that Dr. Bennis sees the world even a little bit, then the session will pay dividends that will go on for many, many years. I've had the opportunity to write books that have been on bestseller lists and things of that nature, and I will tell you that 100% of the inspiration has come from Dr. Bennis, and he probably doesn't know that, but it's true. I'm here because he's at USC, and I have written the books because he's inspired them. And I say that not, again, to in any way highlight myself, but there are thousands of people around the world that would say exactly the same thing, people far more influential or successful than I will ever be. It's said of leaders that leaders promote and support other leaders, who in turn support and promote other leaders. And by that definition, you won't find a greater leader in the world than Warren, because he promotes the people and supports the people who support the people who support the people who support the people who actually do leadership. I had the opportunity to meet our second guest, Tony Hsieh, a couple of years ago. I got an email from him in his characteristic lowercase style that he's famous for on email, saying, "Hi, Dave, you don't know me. My name is Tony Hsieh. I run a company called Zappos." I had heard of neither Tony Hsieh nor Zappos, which I'm embarrassed to say. And I was talking to my wife about the fact that I get emails from time to time, and she said, "Well, like who?" And I mentioned those two names, and after she called me an idiot for a couple of minutes, she said, "You have no idea how special that company was." And so I got to know Tony, went out to Las Vegas. If you ever have the opportunity to go see Zappos, it is like going to the Mecca of organizational culture. In other words, we can have intellectual discussions about it, but until you see it, until you experience it, then you don't really understand what organizational culture can be. The thing about Tony is he exemplifies, he is the walking embodiment of the values of Zappos. So in a sense, you don't need to go to Zappos, although very much hope you all do. It will blow your minds in a very good way. But Tony is the walking embodiment of the values of his company, things like humility. He's been called quirky. One of the values of Zappos is be a little bit weird, okay? And Tony exemplifies that with pride. Most of all, service. I was in a meeting with Tony not too long ago, and I looked to where he had been sitting and realized he wasn't sitting there anymore because he was refilling someone's water glass. Service is the most important value of Zappos, and again, he exemplifies it. So what we have the opportunity to do here today is to hear a conversation between literally two of the most interesting people in the world when it comes to leadership, advances in organizational culture, and doing things that leave the rest of the world really scratching their heads, wondering, how did they do that? So, ladies and gentlemen, please help me in welcoming Dr. Warren Bennis and Mr. Tony Hsieh.
David, thank you for that marvelous introduction to Tony and me. This really isn't as bad as it looks, incidentally. It was once said about the music of Wagner that it was Mark Twain, actually, said about the music of Wagner, "It ain't nearly as bad as it sounds." Well, this is sort of the way I feel, but had I been wearing a pair of Zappos shoes, I never would have made the terrible fall I made 4 weeks ago. And it's going to take me a little while to get over a bunch of broken bones and all that stuff, but it'll get better, and I'm just so pleased to be here with Tony Hsieh. We talked a little bit about what we might do this morning, mm-hmm. and I prepared a couple of questions before in which he's not seen, And he's prepared a couple of questions, I think, which I know I've not seen. And we thought what we would do is exchange questions. I have three or four. Tony may have a certain number. And then we're going to open it up for you to ask questions of us. If that's a way of proceeding, which I hope is agreeable for you all. So let me start in with a couple of these questions that I should have here for Tony. So I put them on 3x5 cards. I'll read it aloud, okay? And I'm going to start with a two-part question. At dinner the other night, this last Thursday night, a woman, a hostess, turned and asked me a question that I've never been asked before. And as David was pointing out earlier, I think the questions we ask are almost more important than the answers we sometimes get. I've often wanted to teach a course on what is a good question. So I think the idea of just exchanging these. So this is a two-part. Part of the other night at this dinner party, the hostess turned to me and said, "At what time in your life have you been the happiest?" I thought, well, that's really an interesting question, I thought. At what point in your life, what time in your life have you been the happiest? And then, Tony, this is the second, it's related, in your March 09 speech that I saw the transparencies for, it was entitled Delivering Happiness. Very interesting. So what I'm going to ask you is, how do you define happiness, and why do you think it is so important?
It's hard to answer the first one, where there's a couple ways I think about happiness. One is, if there's specific moments, there's definitely moments that just stick with me, and I'm sure with everyone. So I actually have a book by the same name that's coming out called Deliving Happiness. It comes out in June, and we actually, I think, have advanced copies for everyone here in the audience. Basically, the book starts out with talking about...
That's the name of the book, Delivering Happiness.
Yes. And the book actually starts out with... So for those... how many of you have heard of Zappos before? And okay, and how many of you have actually shopped with Zappos before? Oh, very cool. For those who may not have heard, Zappos was acquired by Amazon last November, but it was announced in July of last year, and we announced it to the company, and then 2 days later, we held an all-hands meeting in Las Vegas, where our headquarters were. We had about 700 or 800 employees in a room, and basically spent an hour going over everything in terms of we were still going to remain independent and still continue building the Zappos brand and culture the way we always have. It was going to be very different from other acquisitions that Amazon had done. And then at the end, we surprised our employees by announcing that Alfred's the CFO and COO, were buying everyone a Kindle. And then we also announced as a surprise that, so in previous all-hands meetings, we had surprised them with giving everyone a one-time bonus of 10% of whatever they had earned in the previous year. And with the Amazon acquisition, one of the things that we were able to do was, normally in acquisition scenarios, they have big, they call them retention bonuses or something that's normally restricted to the top, say, 10 or 15 people in the company. And we wanted to instead spread it around to all the employees. So we announced that we were going to give them actually 40% of whatever they had earned in the previous 12 months. And so, like, that moment when they heard that number, it was spontaneous. Like, the entire room just stood up and cheered, and people were crying. And there were some people that now they could take their kid to Disneyland, which they couldn't afford to do before. And there were other people where they were wondering how they were going to get a medical procedure, and now this enabled that. And so it was just... You know, that one moment, it wasn't about the money. It was everyone, like, standing up and cheering and crying and, you know, doing that simultaneously. Like, that was one of the happiest moments for not just me, but for everyone. And we were all know, experiencing that together. And so that was pretty special. And then how do you define happiness and why do you think it's so important? One question I like to ask people is, and I would ask you guys to think about, like, what is your goal in life? You know, if you ask different people that question, you'll get different answers. Some people will say they want to grow a business. Other people say they want to find a boyfriend or girlfriend. Or other people say they want to run a marathon. If you think about what your actual answer is, and then the next question is, why? And then people will have different answers, like, so I can find a soulmate, or so I can be healthier, or so I can make more money. And then you ask why again, and then people will come up with different answers. But what's interesting is if you ask why, ask yourself why enough times, and ask other people why enough times, eventually everyone comes to the same answer, and it's that they believe that whatever their goal in life is will ultimately bring them happiness. And so, you know, we're all connected in terms of we're ultimately all just seeking happiness. And so, you know, there's been a lot of research, especially over the past 12 years or so. There's this whole field called positive psychology that's really just about the science of happiness. I'm not talking about going to the self-help section and just think positive and be happy. It's like actual research that has been done. And, you know, one of the things that has come out of the research is that people are actually very bad at predicting what will make them happy, bring them happiness in the long term. And, you know, there's been studies of lottery winners, for example, where you look at their happiness right before winning the lottery, and then you look at their happiness a year later, and a year later it's the same or, you know, even lower than it was before. And yet, I ask everyone here, if you would like to win the lottery tomorrow, and do you think that would make you happier? Probably everyone would say yes. So I thought that was interesting, and originally I was just reading, this was a couple years ago, I was just reading it, studying it just as a hobby, and then kind of realized that actually there's a lot of stuff that's come out of the research that's already been done that you can apply to business in terms of making customers happy, in terms of making employees happy. For example, one framework that I talk about in the book is that happiness is about just four things: perceived control, perceived progress, connectedness, meaning the number and depth of your relationships, and then being part of something bigger than yourself that is meaningful to you. Some of the stuff we kind of stumbled on at Zappos, and then other stuff, because of the frameworks that has come out of the research that's been done, can actually be more purposeful about applying it to business. So, for example, in terms of perceived progress, we used to hire people in our merchandising department, entry level, give them all the training and so on, and then they would get a promotion 18 months later, and then they would get trained and certified and so on, and then get another promotion 18 months later. And so over a three-year period, they'd go from entry-level to becoming a full-fledged buyer at Zappos, which is kind of a big thing within our company. Well, we changed it a couple years ago so that instead of a promotion every 18 months, we gave smaller promotions every 6 months. And they still went through the exact same process and, you know, still had to get certified and so on. It still took 3 years to become a buyer, but we found that employees were much happier because they had the sense of ongoing progress every 6 months instead of waiting 18 months. I think it's just really interesting how you can take the stuff that's come out of the research and apply it to business.
I think you also said in your book, or one of the articles about you, is that happiness is also contagious. I think it is, in some curious way. It's a tough concept to get your arms around it, but I agree with Tony, there's a growing field with now even being called by some of the happiness industry. And in a way, it's a nice counterbalance to a society where we've been so, at least clinically speaking, psychologically speaking, so connected with the idea of pathologizing everything. It's a very hard thing to define. In the trade, it's called subjective well-being. You know, that's the usual term used for general happiness. And it's an interesting field, and I think what could be more appropriate to a service business than that? You are delivering happiness to your clients, to your customers.
So what's interesting is that that's how we initially started. We were really focused on trying to deliver the best customer service and customer experience to make customers happier. And then trying to create a culture that so that employees still want to be around 10 years down the road. That's about making employees happier. And then going back to the fourth, I talk about perceive control, perceive progress, connectedness, and being part of something bigger than yourself. That not only applies to individuals, but it applies to companies as well. And Dave Logan's book, Tribal Leadership, we actually have classes at Zappos where we teach his book and go over his book. And so, you know, his framework is about there being five levels of companies or company culture or people. So his level four is about companies where it's the entire company is unified in a team. It's like we're unified, we're all aligned, and we're better than the competition. But then his examples of level five behavior is it's not about killing the competition. His example is Amgen is, when asked who your competition is, it's not naming some other drug company. It's our competition is cancer. For us, you know, part of the purpose of the book and what we try to do at Zappos, as and this has kind of evolved over the past few years, is it's not just about making our employees happy or making our customers happy, but sharing with the world the mistakes we've made and the lessons we've learned, and to help make other companies have stronger cultures and make their own customers happier.
One thing I was curious about in your background, Tony, was the first company you started, which you ended up selling to Microsoft, as I recall, back in 1998, something like that. And I was surprised there, because you said you started off with a very small group of 5 to 10 people, and then when you got to 100 people, as I recall, you then felt that the company culture had lost its way. Now, what I was wondering about is, this is the Starbucks story, too. It came out a couple of years ago, a leaked memo that he had written, that we're not the Starbucks that we used to be. We're not somebody I know for years now. We met each other before as friends, not anything to do with his business. But he stayed around to revive that company. You sold yours. I'm not making any judgment about that decision, but I was curious as, why didn't you start thinking about reviving the culture that you started with rather than selling it? Do you think it was hopeless or what? Or was it an irresistible price?
It was probably a combination. We actually hired an outside CEO and at the previous company, Link Exchange. Well, and just to give some background, because basically in 1996, with a college roommate, started a company called Link Exchange, and we grew that to about 100 or so people, and then 2.5 years later, sold it to Microsoft. But what most people don't know was really the primary motivation for selling the company was just because it just wasn't a fun place to work at anymore, and the culture just went completely downhill because we just didn't know any better to pay attention to it. I remember when it was just 5 or 10 of us, it was a lot of fun. It was kind of like your typical dot-com back at the time. We were, you know, working around the clock, had no idea what day of the week it was, sleeping under our desks, showering occasionally. And we hired all the people with the right skill sets and experiences, but not all of them were culture fits. And it's not that any one hire brought the company culture downhill. Just slowly over time, it just degraded. We didn't know any better to try to actively manage the culture. And so I just remember one day I just kept hitting the snooze button over and over again because I dreaded going into the office. And that was kind of a weird feeling because this was a company I co-founded. And if I myself didn't want to go into the office, then wondered how all the other employees felt. I also wasn't in control of the company anymore because we had hired an outside CEO.
And oh, I see.
So, and I wasn't, you know, the sole shareholder of the company either. Yeah. So it was just easier to sell the company and then start something new at that point.
Do you have a question for me?
What's been the most surprising thing that you've learned over, say, the past however long you've been in the guru business?
It's funny you ask that question because, well, I'm going to push Tony's book. Again, Delivering Happiness. It's coming out when?
June 7th.
Yeah. I've read parts of it, not the whole book. It is really neat and writes very well and I think an important book. And I think it's going to do well. I charge for blurbs these days, but I'd be willing to say, give you one free. So it's a marvelous book. Congratulations. I think it's going to make a difference. And the reason I'm bringing your book up is to push my own. Oh. And it's my, I don't know, I don't think it's going to be my last book, but it's going to be my 30th book. And it's a memoir, which is a kind of a very difficult thing to do, because it's very delicate, because on the one hand, you've got to avoid two things. One is you've got to avoid your kind of a grandiosity, how terrific I've been and all that. You've got to also avoid the equal difficulty of false modesty. One of our former presidents, Teddy Roosevelt, in his autobiography, he wrote, "The bravest man I ever met in the world was the sergeant who followed me up the hill at San Juan." Well, is that subtle when you think about that? You know, so you got to avoid both those things. Why I'm intrigued with that question of yours, the title of the book, this memoir, which is coming out later in the year, it's called Still Surprised.
I do not know that.
Yeah, that's what's why your question is so fascinating. And so I'm, the beauty of being in university, the beauty of not just being in university, but of life for people, it's related to one of the things that you write about in your core values, but humility. The beauty of my life is continually being surprised about the world, about what's going on, about almost everyday occurrences. And I guess if I were to think about, as I review the things I've done in my life, Tony, and I've been so blessed, it's so funny because we come from, you and I, from two opposite, totally opposite backgrounds. You were born here with Taiwanese parents. I don't know about your parents, but I was born in the Bronx of working class parents. And yet, when I read your work, I'm amazed at how much aligned it is with, and I must also say surprised, though we come from such different cultures, how we've ended up pretty much in the same place in terms of ideas, not in terms of income. I want to make that clear. Okay. Although, I might as well get it in now before the morning goes on too long. I don't get a fee for that. You know, I used to speak for fees only. Usually I get something of a fee. So I have gone on the internet a couple of nights ago, and I sent you two books, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And this is, you're going to be my, it's not a fee exactly, but this is what's called an exchange. For those two books, I've ordered a model shoe I want.
Okay.
And I've written it all out. It's model 993, New Balance. I've got very wide feet, so it's the number, the order number is SKU, number 7465965. And it's, they're not that cheap, by the way. But it's my favorite shoe. And,
okay. This is, so you have not actually ordered it? Or?
What?
You have ordered? I wasn't clear if you had actually ordered it or you would like.
Oh, no, I haven't. I thought I would order it directly with
okay.
the owner.
Well.
My home address, all the details are there.
Okay.
10 and a half, 4E.
Oh, that really
new,
is your
new
home
balance,
address.
Yeah.
All right, I'll make sure.
If I had worn those shoes the other day, I would not have been tripped on some dumb rug. In nearby.
Well, so, it seems like a fair trade. Like, I'll get you something for your feet, and you get.
And the next time I see
hands.
You, the price of the books go up because I'm going to actually personally. No, they're signed. So.
No, they're going for a lot on eBay.
So about sir. so about surprise. I guess. Yeah, I'll tell you one thing that comes quickly to my mind is. The surprise of the potentiality of growth, because I know that though you don't use these specific words, and I want to get back to my next question about culture. I've been teaching this course jointly with soon-to-be succeeded president, Steve Sample, who's been over almost 20 years a great, great university president. You went to a school called Harvard, which hasn't had such good success with their presidents in recent years. But never mind that. I don't want to get into that. I'm amazed at the potential for growth. Surprised that this is an honors program we teach. We have like 300 students applying. We take 40. And every year I'm impressed with how much the richness of the life of learning. The beauty and the surprise of my life is I get paid for the pleasure of finding things out. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, you know, in a way, we're in the same business. I mean, I don't consider myself an entrepreneur. I admire enormously entrepreneurs, by the way. And I'm so glad that USC has been one of the leaders. And in fact, to my knowledge, it's the first university that really put an emphasis on an entrepreneurial thing. So I guess it's my continual surprise at the potentialities for growth and change and learning and of seeing this occur almost before your eyes, like time-lapse photography in a course of a semester, which is saying a lot. You get more of a sense of one another thing that you emphasize very much is self-awareness. It's how much self-awareness and growth and learning come through that. So can I get to my next question to you? This is from a PowerPoint presentation you gave last year, and it's Zappos Core Values. One of the things about Tony's book and about his firm is the whole emphasis on core values. And I want you to talk a little bit about how you develop those. Well, there are 10 of them. How do you build and sustain and keep revivifying, or keep passion and the happiness? So it's building and sustaining. How does a leader do that? When you sold Link Exchange to Microsoft, I mentioned this earlier, because the culture worsened, those are your words. I said, why didn't you try to revive it? I think of Howard Schultz's, I'm closer to that experience because he really felt they lost their way. How does, here we're 120,000 employees. How many employees do you have? 1,600?
Roughly 1,600.
Yeah. How do you build those values at Zappos, and how do you sustain them? It's a critical issue because I agree totally with you that the culture that one works in is that culture of the great happiness and love for the work, right? And the 10 values, you may or may not want to refer to them, but here, this is your PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. But tell about building a culture, and a culture of growth and learning and happiness.
I think this was a story about Starbucks that I heard back a few years ago where this may be, I don't know if this is legend or if it's actually true, but I heard someone ask Howard Schultz, how do you get all your employees to smile all the time? This was back in the early days, and his response was, I just hire people that smile. It's a lot easier than trying to train someone to smile. And so, we have the same philosophy at Zappos. You know, a lot of companies have things called, they might call them core values or guiding principles or whatever, but I think the problem with most companies that have them is they're usually kind of very lofty sounding. They read like they were written by the PR department, and you know, maybe you learn about it on day one of orientation, but then it just becomes this meaningless plaque on the lobby wall. And so for us, we actually do two separate sets of interviews when we hire employees. The first set is by the hiring manager and his or her team, and it's kind of the standard looking for fit within the team, relevant experience, technical ability, and so on. But then our HR department does a separate set of interviews purely for culture fit, for core values, and they have to pass both in order to be hired. We've passed on a lot of really smart, talented people that we know can make an immediate impact on our top or bottom line, but if they're not a culture fit, then we won't hire them. So you mentioned we have 10 core values. We actually have interview questions for each and every one of those core values. So one of our core values is create fun and a little weirdness. And one of our interview questions is literally on a scale of 1 to 10, how weird are you? And
By the way, that's another question that's just coming up for you.
Okay.
Go on with that.
If you're a 1, you're probably a little bit too straight-laced for Zappos. If you're a 10, you might be a little bit too psychotic for us. And but it's actually not the number that matters so much as it is just seeing how candidates respond, because some of them are trying to fish for the right answer, and they're like, well, what's your answer? And then they try to come up with the right thing. It's for us, our belief is that everyone's a little weird somehow, and it's really just more a fun way of saying that we really recognize and celebrate each person's individuality, and we want their true personalities to come out in the workplace environment, whether it's dealing with each other as coworkers or with customers over the phone. Our phone calls are not scripted. We really leave it up to each rep to interact in a way that fits their personality to form a personal emotional connection with each customer, one phone call at a time, and that's how we build our brand. Another one of our core values is to be creative, adventurous, and open-minded. And so one of our interview questions is, on a scale of 1 to 10, how lucky are you in life? And 1 is, I don't know why bad things always seem to happen to me. 10 is, I don't know why good things always seem to happen to me. We try not to hire the ones because they're bad luck, and we don't want bad luck to come to Zappos. But this was actually inspired by a research study I'd read about several years ago, where they actually asked that question to a bunch of random people and got answers all over the board, some ones, some tens, a lot in between. And then afterwards, they had them do a task. And the task was to go through a newspaper and count the number of photos that were in that newspaper. But what the participants didn't know was that it was actually a fake newspaper. And sprinkled throughout the newspaper were these headlines that would say things like, if you're reading this headline, you can stop. The answer is 37, plus collect an extra $100 when you tell the researcher this. And what they found was that the people that consider themselves unlucky in life generally never noticed the headlines. They just went through the task at hand and eventually came up with the right answer. And the people that consider themselves lucky in life generally saw the headlines, stopped early, made an extra $100. So the takeaway is that it's not that people are inherently lucky or unlucky, but luck is really more about being open to the opportunity beyond just how the task or situation presents itself. Yeah. And so that's why we ask that question for our core value number 4.
You know, I think it's an amazing question. And Napoleon, by the way, when he was thinking about appointing an officer into a high general position, would always ask them to feel they were lucky. When you get over the modesty thing, when people say, yeah, I've just been lucky, but when they really talk of the attitude of feeling lucky, there has a lot to do with positive outlook. Because I do think, from a lot of evidence we have, that luck does play, circumstances does play an important role. But people who feel lucky tend to have a very positive outlook in the studies I've done of leadership. Hopeful, not stupid about, they're aware of the dangers too, but they tend to think of themselves as... But the thing about the hiring process at Zappos is this. I would think, Tony, that there's no way, even in the interview, where you would be able to predict how a person would respond to those core values without having them experience the company for 2 or 3 years. It would seem to me that, maybe that's too long a period of time, but it would seem to me that I would think, reading about your company, that you would want to bring people in who are young and who could develop and internalize those values over time. And with some, it just wouldn't work.
I guess we're less about trying to get people to adopt these values. It's more about just finding people whose personal values match the company's core values.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to always be thinking about it. I mean, it's just much easier. Like, every employee just automatically is living the brand. I guess the way I think about it is, you know, there are companies out there that really focus on what they say, and then there's companies out there that focus on behavior, so what they do. And then for us, we think it's just much easier in the long run to just focus on who we are. If you're hiring people who are inherently, their personal values are the Zappos core values, then you don't need to focus on telling them how to behave, because it just is a natural byproduct, and you don't need to come up with all these policies and procedures, and, you know, which also works for some companies, like Disney and Ritz-Carlton, for example, they dictate certain behaviors. You have to walk a customer to the elevator, for example, or when you point, make sure to use your hand or two fingers, but not a single finger. And, you know, you can come up with that as a way of creating a great customer experience as well. But I think the challenge with that is it's hard to predict every possible scenario that might occur. So our philosophy is really make sure everyone understands the vision for Zappos. And for us, it's about making customers happy, delivering the very best customer service and customer experience, and then focus on culture and hiring employees whose personal values match our core values. And most of the rest of the stuff just takes care of itself. And you don't really need to talk about what scripts to use on the phone or come out with, there's a lot of corporations out there trying to figure out what their social media policies should be. And, you know, ours is just be real and use your best judgment. And, mm-hmm. you know, we trust our employees.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you have, let's do just two more. You got one for me and I got one more for you.
Tell me about, in your life, the one of the most disappointing moments for you, what you learned from that experience.
You ask good questions.
I steal them from Dave Logan.
Yeah. Dave Logan steals them from me. Where is he? Now, as a matter of fact, I've actually wanted to teach a course with somebody I want a partner to teach with. What makes a good question? I mean, that's a question that facilitates, the question that has resonance. To ask that good question is, for me, so important. And that's why I thought this exchange of questions would be good. But I keep forgetting the questions you asked me just then.
Tell me about one of the most disappointing moments in your life.
I was going to say real estate, but that's too glib. First of all, the reason why it's a marvelous question is because I have to think, because I tend not to regret things that are disappointments, but to just say, what the hell did I learn from it? The first thing that came to my mind, though, was first couple of years, I was president of university, and I feel I made one big, big mistake. Huge. And it was becoming president of the University of Cincinnati back in the 70s. It was a university that really, in some basic ways, needed to change. When I say basic ways, it was going to go broke unless it became a fully state-supported university, which it now is. And I came in from the East as an outsider, you know, from Harvard, MIT, that kind of a... I didn't take the time to really understand the city, its proudness. The difficulty is it was a city university, but only 6% of the revenue for the university was coming from the city. So it was partly a myth. It took us 3 years of my work there to become, to finally when I got into knowing and learning more. And I realized that one of the toughest things for a change agent as I was brought in to be, is how do you both celebrate and adhere to the symbols of the past and yet invent a new culture and to walk, navigate it without seeming disrespectful to 100 years of previous history where you're starting something new. And I felt I never took the time, though I was warned, I was said, look, this is a very proud city. It's very conservative. In fact, Mark Twain, who I quoted earlier, said the most marvelous thing about Cincinnati, about its conservative ways. He once said, if the world ever comes to an end, I want to be in Cincinnati, because it will happen there 10 years later. So, but I did not realize, Tony, that it is disrespectful to think you're going to change a culture without really taking the time to deeply understand that culture in which the foundation was laid before you can reinvent. Carly Fiorina is a good example of that. It's what I call a contextual intelligence. people talk a lot about social emotional intelligence, very, very important. Equally important is from the old musical, The Music Man, you gotta know the territory. And Carly Fiorina is a good example. A woman who, when she was appointed to CEO of HP, I was rooting for her. She was the first woman, she was the first non-engineer, and most importantly, she was the first non-HP person ever to be appointed CEO. And I kept being continually disappointed when I would meet with HP executives and they would tell me how she never got the engineering culture. She got seduced by the publicity, by being the poster girl, by being at the Davos conferences and, you know, what I call the elephant bumping conferences where the big shots get together. And it's easy as a younger executive with overnight success to get seduced. And in her case, she never learned the culture. And I think my biggest disappointment, my first couple of years at Cincinnati, was people told me, just take your time to get to know the community, the faculty, your students. Don't get into the press. Some very kind of Scandinavian culture. No puppy should be taller than the other, you know? And I listened to it. I mean, I heard it, but I didn't take it in. And I was looking back on that period, my first 2 years there, I already felt, boy, that's something I'm never going to... That notion of contextual intelligence, and I see smart leaders failing all the time. One of the biggest reasons I think I've seen some CEOs, top leaders fail, is not understanding the territory and that the situation. Senator John Kerry, a perfectly smart, able man, no matter what one's politics are, he's a beautiful example of this, almost as good as Carly. In fact, in some ways, a better example. This is a true story from one of his campaign managers. When he was running for president in 2004, he was in Pittsburgh, a working-class town, and he was asked what his favorite sport was. He said, sailing. And then he was asked who was his favorite athlete. This is by the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette sports reporter. Well, that year, Lance Armstrong was an American hero. Won the Tour de France, et cetera, et cetera. Who does John Kerry mention? The German who came in second in the Tour de France.
Well, I guess Jim Collins, I think I heard this from Jim Collins, who wrote Good to Great, the short phrase to summarize what you've been saying is rather than try to be interesting, be interested. That phrase is always stuck with me.
Well, that means listening, doesn't it? Listening. Let me just comment. And well, then let's open it up to the audience,
yeah.
Okay? I just want to make a little riff on listening. I honestly believe that it's one of the most powerful aspects of leadership, listening, not just hearing. In the Middle East, they have a great expression for leaders who stop listening, hearing. They say he's got tired ears. And there's something so disrespectful about not being listened to, not being... The word respect comes to my mind a lot. It's a big aspect of leadership, I think, is respect, is really, really, really hearing and listening others. In your case, the customer, but also your employee, you know. Okay, let's open it up. David, shall we...
You know, it's interesting you're talking about happiness and your idea that happiness is moments versus sort of that sustained, serene, sublime sense of satisfaction and happiness. And we live in a very complicated world where there is no lack of bad news and grim prognostications. I was seeing a quote the other day from Ronald Reagan, and he said, "Optimistic thinking is a choice and, frankly, a good choice." And then there was a gentleman, I don't know if it was Martin Seligman, that wrote the book Learned Optimism, if you've ever read that book.
What's the book called?
Learned Optimism.
And Seligman.
Right. I think it was Martin Seligman. He did this great study on the MetLife salesman and who was more successful. And it turned out they profiled, they were the optimist and the pessimist. and the optimists sold 27% more than the pessimists did.
They also live longer, by the way.
And live longer. But the other thing that what he reluctantly acknowledged toward the end of the book was, it says, and I'm sort of quoting this out of context, it says, optimists tend to be slightly out of touch with what's going on, but they're happier. And pessimists tend to see better what's going on. They're slightly sadder, but they're in better context with what's really going on around them. And so I guess my question to you is that if we are listening and watching, you can't help but see all the negative potentials, whether it's in your business, the world around you, the economy, certainly the healthcare debate has accelerated that in the most gruesome way. How do you achieve happiness while still staying in real touch with what's going on around you?
Well, I guess I would have two answers to that. I remember when I was in Kentucky, where our warehouse is, was watching in the hotel lobby, there was this comedian on TV, and he said, basically, you have a choice when you're married. You can either be happy, or you can be right. And you can't. And so, and he's, you know, with his relationship, was choosing to be happy. I think a lot of it, it's not so much about being out of touch as it is about just deciding what to focus on. Well, we were talking about earlier in terms of the optimism that entrepreneurs have, but the entrepreneurs that are able to create businesses are still in touch with all the realities, but they are optimistic about what can be accomplished. But then, and I guess I would separate that from people that are just not in touch at all with reality and, you know, are always optimistic, even if the reality of the situation is says they shouldn't be. So I think it's a subtle difference, but maybe rather than use the word optimism, which, you know, different people have different interpretations of, I would use entrepreneurial-like optimism.
I think it's a marvelous question, just a quick response. I think, true, you can see both sides of it, as just Tony was saying, but it'd be nice to have a couple of people around you if you're a person like me. And I think it's no accident that my wife I call Dr. No, because I tend to be impulsive about certain things, and she's always there. You know, in my memoir, I have a line that says, any man over 60 should marry a doctor. I did. And so she's always ready to say, why are you doing this? And why? I mean, sometimes it gets to be a pain in the neck, but I always find it useful. So putting it into an executive suite, to have some people around you who tend to look at the dark side more than you do, it's quite helpful.
This question is for Tony. By the way, Tony, my name is James Shea, and I have to thank you for bringing the Shea's name to a worldwide brand household name.
Okay. Oh, by the way, just a comment. So last name is spelled H-S-I-E-H.
Yes.
And
you're not Irish. I thought. You know.
And so I'm sure you've come across the same issue, but anytime I try to spell it out to people, I'd say 80% of the time, if I just say H-S-I-H, they write S-H. And so...
Brother, I feel your pain.
Okay.
Yes.
But so I'm going to...
And whoever invented our last name spelling, I must contest.
But I'm going to give you some tips, actually, that I've learned over the years. So what I found is, for whatever reason, if you just say H-S-I-E-H, people almost always write down S-H. But if you say H as in Harry, S as in Sam, I-E-H, they always get it right.
That's exactly how I do it, too.
Really?
Well,
and you
great.
Use Harry and Sam? That's weird. Yeah. Anyways.
So,
So I always thought, like, you know, the last name was one of those things that just didn't make sense because it's pronounced Shea, but it's I before E. It's just really confusing. But I did discover if you actually translate it into Morse code, it's 4 dots, 3 dots, 2 dots, 1 dot, 4 dots. So, there's a
wow, lot. I learned something today. So, well, first of all, thank you for making us famous. But at the same token, thank you for putting a lot of pressure on me. You know, one day my father opened up the newspaper and showed me the newspaper and saying, hey, son, this kid, Tony Shea, is only 33. You're almost 40. And how come your income's much less than his? And we're both in the internet field. I own an internet marketing consulting company. And so I have this question for you.
Did you ask permission to ask a second?
Oh, may I ask you the most important question, I guess, is that I know you emphasize a lot on culture, your company culture. And I can't help stop thinking this is what made Zappos very profitable today. Did you have the foresight that shaping this culture was going to make your company profitable, or was it just happened naturally for you?
Originally, it was just for selfish reasons. I was more just thinking about what would I personally enjoy. And, you know, for the first 4 or 5 years, culture, it was more about I didn't want to make the same mistake I made at Link Exchange. So we always said, okay, culture is important. But it wasn't actually until 5 years or so into it that we decided to actually make culture the number one priority for the company. And so it was only at that time that we explicitly, you know, went through this year-long process of asking our employees what should our core values be, and then put into place all the processes and procedures, you know, like the two sets of hiring interviews that we do. And then part of me, and it was probably right about that time where I read Good to Great by Jim Collins, and so I don't think we're really pioneering anything new. Like, we're just, I guess, learning on our own what's already been researched out there. In Good to Great, Jim Collins talks about, you know, they look at what separates the great companies from just the good ones in terms of long-term financial performance. And two of the things that they found the great companies had that the good ones didn't were, one was a really strong culture or core values. One of the things they found was that it actually doesn't matter what your core values are. It just matters that you have them and you commit to them, because that creates alignment in the entire organization. Everyone speaks a common language, and it's just a default way of thinking. And then the second thing was having a vision or higher purpose beyond just money or profits or being number one in the market. And so those were things that, you know, we kind of accidentally stumbled into and, you know, slowly over time adopted for ourselves. And it just, I think we just got lucky in that it actually turns out to be the stuff that Jim Collins says we should do. And same with the tribal leadership. They found similar things.
David, is there a chance, would you mind if your 10 values, Zappos core values, were distributed to the Omni?
They're actually in the book, too.
So it's in the book. Okay, good, because I think they're so, and if there were time to get into how we created this in the organization is really interesting.
So in just a few moments we have left, let's turn to what we call burning questions, which means if you don't ask the question that you have in mind, there's a chance you may spontaneously combust later in the day. So we have a burning question back here.
Thanks for coming out here. You had mentioned in that the culture, when you first started, kind of got away from you. And we've read countless case studies of cultures that have started strong and then sort of meandered off to the side, which would make the assumption that a culture can change even without the consent of the very top. So for those of us who are in the middle of an organization, how can we impact and sort of course correct the culture to make it for the better? Because obviously it happens, but what active steps can we do to sort of change the direction the way we might think things should be?
So for us at Zappos, most organizations, as they grow larger, the culture goes downhill, and it can't be up to just the top, however many, you know, executives or whatever. Not only do we not want the culture to go downhill, but we actually want it to get stronger and stronger as more employees come. Like, we want the culture to scale. And so the only way that can happen is if every employee views as part of his or her job responsibility to live and inspire the culture in others and help build those cultures. And so we're always trying to think of, okay, what's next? And actually, one of the pretty exciting projects that we're working on internally is actually a result of Dave Logan's work and he talks about how many of you have read Tribal Leadership? He talks about creating triads and basically three-person relationships instead of two-person relationships. And, you know, there's a few interesting things about that. If you actually graph out the relationships in an organization, and he actually just visited Zappos a few weeks ago and showed us a sample company they had worked with, it actually doesn't take that many, if you're strategic about it, it actually doesn't take that many triadic relationships to actually shift a culture from level three to level four, or just get everyone more connected. And so one of the things that we're in the process of building at Zappos is actually using our own internal tools, we have this thing called the face game, where as part of the process of logging into our systems, it actually just shows you a random employee's face, and then it used to be it's multiple choice, you have to guess who it is, and then once you guess it, then it shows you that employee's bio and, you know, kind of like the equivalent of a Facebook profile page, but it's on our internal system. So we actually just launched and modified the system so that if they guess correctly, it'll ask them, how well do you know this person on a scale 1 to 5, and 5 being we're going to be lifelong friends, and 1 or 2 is I'll say hi to them if I happen to pass in the hallway. And so from that, our system is basically we want to create our own internal social graph that looks at not only how many triads we have, but the strengths, the different types of triads and strengths of triads, and then we want employees to be more conscious about just the concept of triads. And one of the interesting things I learned from the book and from Dave Logan about triads is that if there's 3 people, so let's say yourself, myself, and one other person, the third person is the one that's responsible for the strength of the other 2 people's relationship. Mm-hmm. And so if you and I get into an argument about shoes or something, then this person acts as kind of moderator. But if each person in the triad actually feels and knows it's their responsibility to strengthen the other 2's relationship, it creates a pretty interesting dynamic. So that's where we're headed, and I think that's something where you don't need to be at the top of an organization to start forming more triads in your company.
We have time for just one more burning question. Okay, saw your hand first.
It's kind of along the line was what he was saying about for culture. Now that you sold a company to Amazon, how do you think the two will mesh together? Because obviously they're very different. And are there steps or agreement between SAPO and Amazon to mesh well together? Or?
So specifically, one of the prerequisites for us to even consider the whole Amazon acquisition was that they leave us independent. And so from our perspective, it's basically been the equivalent of swapping out our board of directors with a new one. Our previous board came more from a technology background, didn't really have much retail experience. And so if anything, you know, having a new board, quote unquote, you know, it's not officially a board, we call it a management committee, but it's basically 3 people from Zappos and 3 people from Amazon. So the equivalent of a board of directors, we meet quarterly. But having a board that gets retail much more, and you know, they have the whole history and really thinks in the long term in terms of customer experience and what's right for the customer, that's been great. But they've also allowed us to do our things the Zappos way, continue to build our culture, our brand, run business our way. And so we've actually come across instances where something is not right for Amazon to do. Like they make a decision about something, they say, no, we're not going to do this, or we're taking this stance on this, and we've taken the opposite stance in terms of, for example, what vendors to work with or even who to partner with, for example. We've actually had a few instances where we've tested our independence and they've remained true to their word.
Let's give them both a round of applause.
This has been an Ashet audio production of Delivering Happiness, A Path to Profits, Passion, and Purpose. Written and read by Tony Hsieh. Produced by John Clem. Directed by Bob Walter. Recorded by Matthew Wong. Post-production by Philip Levy and John Clem. Delivering Happiness is also available in print from Business Plus, a division of Ashet Book Group. Text copyright 2010 by Tony Hsieh. Audio production copyright and published 2010 by Ashet Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher.